guardian.co.uk.
The Books Podcast from guardian.co.uk.
Hello, and this is the Guardian Book Club. I'm Claire Armistead, the literary editor. Our subject, Sue Townsend, proved herself a true trooper braving snowdrifts and black ice to get to us in London from her home in Leicestershire just before Christmas. She was with us to discuss the secret diary of Adrian Mole, aged 13 and three quarters. Adrian Mole is now in his 40s, the unlikely hero of nine novels, now sadly suffering from prostate cancer. But 28 years ago, as Book Club Chair John Mullen pointed out, he was just another pesky Guardian reader.
Thanks for proving yourself, as Adrian would say, true intellectuals, by braving the elements and not letting a little flurry or two put you off learned discourse about bookish matters. Just to show that Sue is a truly fearless author, she actually risks on page 43 of the first book in the Adrian Mole series alienating her likeliest readers by having Adrian, when he takes up a newspaper round, I'm sure you'll all remember, people complained because the papers were late. I had a Guardian left over in my paper bag, so I took it home to read. It was full of spelling mistakes. It is disgusting when you think of how many people who can spell are out of work.
Was it reasonable to ask whether there was any sort of original Adrian whose voice you heard or whose preoccupations you witnessed who went into this?
Well, I've come to the conclusion that I am Adrian Mole. Yeah. I mean, as Flaubert, it always sounds pretentious when you name an author, but Flaubert was asked, where did you find Madame Bovary? And he said, c'est moi. Of course it's me, yeah.
So Adrian, so which of his leading characteristics are most guiltily yours?
Secrecy. I was a secret writer for 20 years. My first husband didn't know I wrote at all. Mostly because he didn't approve of me reading. At the end of a row, the traditional thing, certainly where I lived at the time, was to throw the woman's clothes out of the window. In my case, he threw my books
out of the window.
Reading books is, I think, not usual where he lives and who he lives with. His mother reads The Female Eunuch, but that's a part of her development as a not very good feminist. She gets the rota for the housework, but as soon as a man sweet talks her, she's off with them.
The book's thing, I think my favourite entry in the whole diary is, I am reading Crime and Punishment. It is the most true book I ever read. I was looking on the book club website today and a couple of people had written in blogs about Adrian Mole. Mm. And one of them, I don't know if they may be here this evening, but anyway, said, I tried keeping a diary last year. I gave up when I realised that every entry made me sound like Adrian Mole. It's not just a question of Adrian Mole's character, but it was a kind of flash of insight to realise that diaries were a sort of inherently comic thing. Mm. Can you remember that inspiration?
Well, I read, Jo Orton's from Leicester, quite near to where I lived and grew up, and as is Colin Wilson. Some of you may not have heard of Colin Wilson. He was a literary sensation.
Yes.
He sat in a sleeping bag on Hampstead Heath, wearing a big intellectual's roll neck sweater, cream, and horn-rimmed glasses, which are essential, of course, if you're an intellectual. His book, The Outsider, happened to coincide with a movement where younger people thought that they should have their voices heard. Both of them wrote diaries, Jo Orton and Colin Wilson, and that both of them, at the age of 11, said almost the same words. They said, I am an intellectual, but yet I live amongst Philistines or something. And I loved that. And I've always liked diaries, secret diaries in particular. You know, more honest, perhaps, than one that somebody's composed for publication.
But, I mean, the person that Adrian reminded me of, especially in his sense of that saving sense he has of being better than the people around him, is a fictional character, which is Pooter in Diary of a Nobody.
Oh, absolutely. I love the grossness, yeah.
And that scene's the same sort of fantastic self-importance, anxious self-importance.
Yeah. Hiding the terrible insecurity.
Yeah.
Knowing that, you know, you're not that much better than the people, you know, who surround you. In fact, they've got a lot of qualities that you will never have.
Yeah. Mm. I think I have my Adrian Molish moments when I think of the story of my day and how I've been frustrated by idiots all the
way. I remember my stepfather laughing out loud when I did go in with The Gambler. I came across it. I knew nothing about Dostoevsky or the Russians. It was during the time that I was buying Penguin books because I'd learned that they were good and you could trust them. And so I did. I bought The Gambler and read it. And it's not a very good book, I know that now, but there was just something about the writing that was so passionate and intense that, you know, I felt, you know, everything shifted. I wanted to know how to pronounce Dostoevsky because nobody I knew knew. So I went to a place where I knew sort of beatnik types hung out, which was the Pancake House.
This was in Leicester,
yeah,
was it?
And I saw a bearded man at the table and thought, I bet he would know. And I went up to him and pushed the book and said, do you know how to pronounce this? And he said, he told me.
Yeah.
And I think he must have been amused because I was about 16, I think, and I had my kind of homemade beatnik outfit on. And we got friendly. I really liked him, and he worked in a bookshop in Leicester. It turned out that he was a lover of the owner of the bookshop, a man called Raymond. And so I started going there, and that was how I started to, you know, have not a reading programme, but just this person's good. It's worth reading this. It's worth reading that. And that's what I did.
So the beard was quite a good guide.
He was a great bloke.
Yeah, but I mean, the beard was quite a good, was in Leicester,
oh, it was a
sign
of
Bohemian affiliation.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And the fact that his sweater was fraying. And when I eventually went to his house, I was taken there by the police because I had missed the last bus home, so I decided to sleep in a bus shelter. And actually, it's got a plaque on it. This bus shelter is still there. But not that I slept there, but... And the police came and said, well, you know, what are you doing? And I said, well, I missed the last bus home. And they said, well, do you want to lift anywhere? Do you want to lift home? And I said, yeah. I will go home. And I knew where Bob lived, in Countersort. But I didn't know which number, which street. So they dropped me off in the middle of Countersort village. It's about 3 o'clock in the morning. I just kind of walked around until I found somebody to ask and said, do you know a bloke with a big beard called Bob? And I said, oh, yeah, he lives down there. And I went there and knocked on the door. And Bill looked out as if every day somebody turned up doing that. He said, oh, hello, come in. The door's not locked. Went in there, he made me a cup of tea. I mean, I was overcome by the smell of mice and mice droppings. And he read to me from, I think it was The Great Gatsby. He read to me while I scrubbed his shelves in his pantry and got rid of all the mouse droppings.
So it's a Bert Baxter type. So
yeah, that, yes. Except he was much younger than Bert Baxter. But yeah, it was, yeah. Yeah. So, you know, thanks to Bob, you know, he's no longer alive. He's, you know, he died. He killed himself, unfortunately. But that was my first experience, really, of that kind of bohemian life where people would rather miss a meal than not buy that book. Books were everything, and they were to me as well. They were everything. I could not have left home without a book. And I always had jobs that you could read. You know, I worked in a very posh dress shop and read in the cubicle. I was reading Oscar Wilde when
the owner found me and gave me the sack and said, you know. I read in a garage forecourt. I used to read a Penguin a day in there. Wasn't very successful again. Yeah, books were everything.
But some of the people, some of the characters, I mean, Adrian's convinced, isn't he, that that he's a singular intellectual. But it's some of the other people do actually read books, don't they? I mean, his mum's reading Simone de Beauvoir.
Yeah.
He says,
yeah.
Well, another sex book, he says.
Yeah,
isn't it?
That's
it,
right.
Because
yeah.
It's called The Second Sex.
It is, yeah. Yeah.
And his dad has odd flashes of literary knowledge, doesn't he?
Yeah. Well, my parents read, and they were both bus conductors at the time I'm talking about, and they read, always had a hardback in their change bag, and they were on country routes, so it was very slow, you know, and so there were books in the house. They used to get library books. My stepfather used to read books about the Second World War, specialist books about the aircraft. And my mother, it was always Hollywood biographies. So I used to know an awful lot about Hedy Lamarr and, the Bankhead woman. What's her name?
Tallulah
Bankhead, who is my hero, heroine.
And Adrian's, the books, one of the things the books seem to do in Adrian Mole's diary is, I don't know if you did this consciously, but it does seem sometimes one of the pleasures of the book is that there's some jokes there which are for adult readers.
Oh, it's for adults.
It's for adults?
It's for adults, yeah.
It's not for...
No, it's never meant for children, no. It was meant for, if you had to kind of narrow it down, to mothers of teenage boys, just to give them an inkling into what is going on in their heads, because most parents have no idea at all. And they say, no, she's my best friend, she tells me everything. She doesn't. She doesn't. I had a really good friend who lived a few doors down, Professor Brandon, who was a wonderful psychologist, and he said, whenever I hear that phrase, she's my best friend, the hairs prickle on the back of my neck, and I'd say to myself, oh God, this is going to be a long one.
But then children do love it. So that was inadvertent,
yeah, they
wasn't
do.
It?
Yeah, they do. What they like is the narrative, the dog. I mean, it starts with the dog, really.
Yeah, well,
the dog
yeah.
gets up to a lot of things. And
don't they also like it because... like we were talking about Just William books before
yeah.
we came in, don't they also like it because although Adrian is laughable sometimes anyway, the book is also a kind of satire on the follies of, I mean, almost all the adults
yeah.
in his life.
Yeah, and
even
like,
though he
yeah.
doesn't necessarily always understand how
That's right.
absurd they are. They're yeah. all absurd, aren't they?
Yeah, they are, yeah. And school and the absurdities
yes.
of school. Rules yes. that you don't understand and nobody does. You wonder where they first started to be implemented.
Mr. Scruton, the headmaster, was that
yes.
a joke for us adults?
Well, it was a joke for me. He was my headmaster when I was in primary school.
Oh, what, is it real? There was a...
He's dead now, safely dead. But I was terrified of him. He was a terrifying man who used to lose his temper constantly. Not for the same thing. Another day he'd lose his temper over something else. You could never be safe with him. You didn't know. And he was quite, you know, he was quite handy with his hand, you know, on the back of the head. You don't know what you've done. He wasn't a good man. But there was a wonderful man who loved comic writing, and his name was Mr. Moles. Moles. And he read to us before we went home. At night, in the afternoon.
And so that's where Adrian's name comes from, is it?
Do you know, I didn't even put the two together. But, you know, I'm a bit thick at times. But it was more to do with being a spy, you know, a mole, and being a kind of lovable, furry, creature that, you know, is already loved in fiction, you know, Wind in the Willows and so on. But... of course, Mr. Moles was very important to me.
Because I think that sort of, I think younger readers, they call them, read it and recognise the sort of dilapidatedness of adult life. You know, these kind of seen from that viewpoint. And but if you're an adult, I guess that
You see it on a different level completely.
Well, I mean, the cadence. You know, I suppose I was making a list of the things I absolutely recognise in Adrian.
Yeah.
Not recognise because I share them with him, because there are those things, but recognising his language. And I suppose the first, the most striking, important one, and the one which seems sort of, which I think is the most brilliant thing, because it belongs to what diaries are like. I mean, solemn, serious Puritan diaries, as well as Mr. Pooter and things. And that is the sort of, the moralism.
Yeah.
The censoriousness.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
You know, and I was kind of thinking, you know, they're sort of...
Yeah, that's
because,
right.
You know, sparing the blushes of anybody listening to the podcast or later or in this hall, younger people are very, very moralistic, aren't they? Very censorious. I think the episode which catches it for me is when Adrian's describing, he goes shopping with his dad in the supermarket. His mum's gone off to Sheffield with Mr. Lucas. And first of all, he says a classic Adrian thing, something like about his father, you know, he bought only things which are bad for you. And then he sees a vicar buying lavatory paper. Do you all know, this, the vicar buying lavatory paper? This poor man, you know, who's kind of...
Soft lavatory paper.
You know, and he says... I must say, I take my hat off to Sainsbury's. They seem to attract a better class of person. I saw a vicar choosing toilet paper. He chose a 4-roll pack of purple 3-ply. He must have money to burn. He could have bought some shiny white and given the difference to the poor. What a hypocrite.
No, that's right.
I hope I'm not offending anybody in the audience when I say that. That catches something about a teenage...
Yeah, very censorious.
Very.
And they can't imagine themselves ever behaving in that way. It's a big shock when you become an adult and how hypocritical you are.
Well, sort of, it's from there, from the way... I mean, his favourite phrases are always things like, it's disgusting, but there's also at the end there's complaint. I was counting, I think he used, I didn't realise it first time around, but looking for the phrase again when I read it another time, that phrase, just my luck.
Just my luck, yeah. Self-pity.
Yes.
Yeah. He's been chosen by the deities to have a bad day.
You know, that's what diaries were invented for, weren't they? Mm. I mean, when people started writing them in the 17th century, it was all these God-fearing people who thought that every tiny little thing that happened to them... was terribly significant because God had sort of...
That's right, yeah.
And he's a bit like that.
He's certainly like that, yeah.
And that...
Because he's this big hero in his life. He's all-consuming, all-powerful, all-wonderful. That we all are. We all have this hideous ego.
Did you think of the things that you could contrive which would allow you to write a sequel or... Or was it just a self-contained creation, which...
I always saw myself writing the second one, The Growing Pains of Adrian Mole, which I think is much better than the first one.
Do you? Why?
Yeah, I do. Well, I think he suffers more. You know, he goes to bed and has a nervous breakdown, what he thinks is a nervous breakdown, because of the Middle East. Which, you know, and he has a lovely, very sympathetic psychologist who, based on Sidney Brandon, my friend, who says to him, the Middle East will never be solved. Oh, it's worth that effect. Don't waste your time on it. And he addresses each point. I think there are 10 points. He addresses each of these points and normalises Adrian, just normalises him. Yeah, Adrian's very, quite sad, I think, in The Growing Pains.
Because one of the sort of perfect things about the first one is that he hasn't yet actually had to kind of confront really bad things. Not really.
No.
And he thinks he's having a nervous breakdown in the first one, doesn't he? And his mother, I think brilliantly, says that it's because he's reading Iris Murdoch.
That's right. That's right.
Which, God, that struck a chord with me, Sue.
I remember, and me as well.
He says, doesn't he? He says, I'm reading. Which Iris Murdoch novel is it that he's reading?
The Sea, I think.
Which one is it? I think it's not. I think it's The Black Prince.
Oh, The Black Prince.
Which is a very weird one. Yeah, that's about somebody who cannot find carnal fulfilment with his much, much younger girlfriend unless she dresses up as Hamlet. I kid you not. That is what happens. And she's the daughter of a writer. I mean, it's a very, very kinky one.
If you don't think that sounds possible, read Kraft Ebbing, who kind of informed you about every kind of social and sexual practice. It's quite extraordinary.
Yeah, Iris Murdoch's quite staid by those standards. I mean, he says, I'm reading The Black Prince by Iris Murdoch. I can only understand one word in 10. This, for me, is so true. It's now my ambition to actually enjoy one of her books. Then I will know I am above the common herd. I mean, that is my adolescence in a vignette.
Mine as well.
Yeah. And then his mother, you know, he says, I'm a nervous wreck. My mother blames my bad nerves on Iris Murdoch. She says painful adolescence shouldn't be read about when one's studying for O-levels. And I suppose in a way, it feels like, you know, if sort of, if I may elevate you by the comparison, if The Secret Diary of Adrian Mole is like As You Like It, and The Growing Pains of Adrian Mole is sort of Measure for Measure.
Oh.
It's darkening, you know. Because I was just actually thinking when I was reading, when is the first actually bad thing going to happen? Because I knew that when, for instance, Pauline goes off with the egregious Mr. Lucas. The first time I read it, I knew she would come back again, I think. And I knew, I'm not saying that's a good thing, but I knew that, as it were, there would be a comic plot and she'd come back, and I knew Mr. Lucas couldn't be for keeps.
No.
And in a way, if you just had The Secret Diary of Adrian Mole, age 13, 3/4, and stopped with that one, you could have avoided doing anything, meeting anything really bad. But as soon as you start going on, you realise that Gran's going to die eventually. And
the real bad thing that happened, of course, was that his parents separated.
Yes.
And I think we underestimate how much pain we cause our children, you know, when we do that. I know people say it's for the best, you know, we were always quarrelling, we were rowing, kids were upset, but that's nothing to what they feel when they separate. You know, and I hate to say this, I hate to say it, but it's actually true that they never, ever stop wishing that their parents would get together. You know, 20 years on, 25 years on, they still have that mad hope that you'll get together and everything will be all right, even though they're now adults themselves with children of their own. You know, I don't want to keep stressing how painful it is for them, but it actually is. And I think we've got a whole generation now, because schools no longer write letters to dear parents. It's now dear parent stroke carer stroke. And it goes on and on. Main carer, secondary carer. So that's what Mole felt.
Yeah, but it's a funny because in the first book he says almost with not sort of he's not pleased about it, but he's really interested. He says, doesn't he say, Mr. and Mrs. Lucas? You know, it's this fantastic thing. Mr. Lucas is visiting his mum all the time, and Mrs. Lucas is always doing something to the outside of her house, isn't she?
Yeah.
So sort of,
she's
always
up
out
the ladder,
there.
Painting.
Yeah, she's up the ladder,
looking in the mum's bedroom. Yeah.
And then he says, Mr. and Mrs. Lucas are getting divorced. They're the first in our street.
Yeah, that's right.
As if it's a sort of, you
know. It was so then. It was extraordinary. I didn't know anybody when I was a child whose parents were divorced or separated even. You know, I mean, I was a child of a widow, you know. And even that was almost scandalous. Mm. I mean, obviously not your making, but, oh, you've only got, you know, you haven't got a dad and all that. You know, it was really strange.
So, but you're slightly cruel to poor old Adrian, because at the end of the first book, he has got his parents back, hasn't he? They have come back together.
Yeah, they do. Yeah.
And but as soon as you commit yourself to sequels, he's going to have all that sort of unravelled.
Well, there's the consequence of having that affair, which is a child is born.
Yeah.
And there are two children born, actually, because the stick insect has a child.
Yes.
And Pauline has a child, Rosie. Yeah.
And it's got that thing. I don't know if you reminded me. I was reminded very much of Adrian Mole when I read... have you read The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, That sort of thing that... I think he's very influenced by Adrian Mole. That thing that there are these dramas going on between adults... Mm. Mm. Which, you know, he even says things like, oh, you know, my dad, which he was holding stick insect by the arm, very kind of him that she was, you know, to help her.
Yeah.
And so there's this kind of, there's this plot thing, which I don't know if, do you think your younger readers get it?
I don't mind if they don't.
No.
So long as they read it every 5 years, I'd say, then they'll get it. They don't. They only get the narrative, and some of the obvious jokes and about parents and school and so on. They really don't get the second layer, let alone the third layer.
I think they get some of those ones about. I was reading a really good novel by a bloke called George Eliot, or
perhaps younger teens. Perhaps they do. Yeah.
And what about the love story? Because I had a really clever, lead-in, which I've spoiled actually for myself. I was going to say, what do the following have in common? Petrarch and Laura, Heathcliff and Kathy, Oscar and Lucinda, Adrian and Pandora.
Yeah.
And so what's the answer? What have they all got in common? These pairs of lovers. Yes, they're unconscious, the great un... Yeah. That was a sort of...
He still hasn't... Yeah.
That's actually a sine qua non, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
All the great love stories, really, have to be unconscious.
You can never, ever... I mean, they've been in bed with each other.
Yes.
In their underwear.
Yes.
And it would have happened had it not been for Alistair Campbell ringing Pandora... And she had to go back to the Commons.
Oh, I haven't read that volume. Yeah, so that's when she's a Labour MP.
Yeah,
they come very close to it, do they?
Yeah, she gets to be a, she gets to be a junior minister for fish. I think. Fish and something else.
Why is it absolutely, absolutely crucial that poor old Adrian can never be allowed to consummate this passion?
Pandora has to be one of those mythical women, perfect woman, perfect. I mean, a bit of a ball breaker, but...
Yeah.
You know, I would like to be like Pandora, I think. Not so cruel. Who wouldn't, you know, speak five languages fluently, including Mandarin? And Serbo-Croat, and looks wonderful in her designer clothes. Chanel, you know. She has no shame, Pandora.
So poor old Adrian, do you think this is a kind of characteristic of the male psyche that Adrian's condemned through all his relationships to find them lacking by the standard of the one that he never managed to...
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I think that's his tragedy as well, yeah. I can't let them...
No.
I just can't.
Okay, well, look, it's time. I'm sure it's more than time for me to throw it open to anybody here who wants to say anything or ask questions about any of the... Sue's open to... She throws her oeuvre Is that right? You throw your herb open to the floor. Please.
I'm sorry, you probably have answered this question loads before, but I don't know the answer. Why did you choose to make him male? If Adrian is you?
Oh, because boys are far more secretive. I mean, they don't talk to their mates about anything that matters very much. They really don't. They don't confess to feeling weak or, you know, having weaknesses. They don't tell their mates about what's going on at home, unless it's totally dramatic and they've been thrown out and social services have been called in. But boys just don't. Girls have more, I think they're more open to discussing their problems or their lives, their true lives, with their girlfriends. And there's something I like, you know, I kind of like geeky boys and geeky men. It's whatever turns you on. Give me a geek any day. No, and people would have thought it was me if it was a girl. I mean, I actually did write, I wrote a column once a week about a girl called Christabel something, a diary of a girl. It just didn't work at all. For a start, they said, the Daily Mail said, we can't have a female character aged 20 who's on the pill. We can't have her living in the caravan. And I'd written about this family that had gone to pot, really. They lost everything, their house, everything, and they had to live in a caravan and had to live. They were poor people. They didn't want that. They wanted somebody successful in. You know, together. And so I got sacked from there. I'm quite proud of that.
Hello. You mentioned that your first husband didn't know that you were writing.
Mm.
Can you tell us a bit about how and why you concealed your writing from him?
From everybody. It was no good. I knew it wasn't any good. You know, when you're reading Dostoevsky and Tolstoy and Updike and... You know, I didn't have... I hate it when people go on about their voice. I didn't have a style of my own. So I was too ashamed to show it to anybody. And it was only when I met my second husband that I did confess to him, late at night, very late, that I'd been writing for 20 years. It was a big drama, you know. I've got something to tell. No, I can't. I don't know what the poor man was expecting. That I got some terrible fetish or something.
So was there a huge sigh when you revealed that?
It was a massive relief to tell somebody.
Well, I was thinking it might be a massive relief for him after the build-up.
Oh, God, yes, it was a relief for him. But I kept all my writings in a big cardboard box that the fridge had been delivered in. And, you know, he said, I don't want to read your writing. I won't read it. But there is a writing class held at the Phoenix Theatre in Leicester. Why don't you go? I just had a baby. And he said, I'll have the baby while you go. And it was held once a fortnight. And so I used to go and I didn't speak for about 6 weeks. And then the director said, Mrs. Townsend, you've been coming for quite a while now. We haven't heard you speak. We haven't read any of your writing. It was for a theatre writers group. You know, obviously it was held at the theatre, but I didn't know that. He said, it'd be very nice if you wrote as a short play. And so I did. I wrote a play called Woomerang, which was, you know, my experiences at that time were hanging around gynecological waiting rooms or, you know, maternity hospitals or something. And I wrote a kind of wish fulfillment play about a waiting room. They were waiting to see the doctor, all these women. And they were extraordinary women. They all got together and they changed the furniture. They read their notes, went to the filing cabinet, read their notes, found out what they were suffering from or not. Ended up with an old lady in her corsets doing a dance on one of the tables, using her false teeth as castanets. And that's a Joe Orton thing. He was, you know, several of his characters did that.
And this that kind one, of Leicester humour.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't laughing actually. And that won the Thames Television Playwrights Award. Although the stage newspaper said it was a bad year. I know, that gave me £1,000 a year, and I had to write a full-length play for the Phoenix Theatre. Well, I wasn't at all confident, and still not really. I wrote a play with 40-odd singing and speaking parts, divided between 11 actors, and it was just ridiculous. It was so difficult, and so to try and get these actors on and off, give them enough room, time to change before they came on to somebody else. Oh, it was just awful. But it went on, and it was successful. And then I met an actor there who asked me for an audition piece for Huckleberry Finn. He was going for the part, and I remembered Adrian Mole. It's called Nigel Mole then. And I gave him these handwritten pages and he typed them up. Didn't get the part, but he sent them to John Tideman at the BBC. He was head of
drama. So the guy that Adrian writes to is... Was
John Tideman's a real person.
A real person, yeah.
In fact, he wrote to me today, yeah.
Because he writes very tolerant letters, really, to Adrian.
He's actually like that.
Yes.
He's the most wonderful man. And he has introduced so many writers. He put on Joe Orton's first play, Ruffian on the Stair. And Joe's first play was for radio. And John stuck by him, supported him. Oh, the list is endless.
He's a brilliant mixture in the books of tolerance and satire, because he does do things like he sends that poem on Norway.
That's right.
To a Norwegian, doesn't he?
To a Norwegian head of drama.
Yes,
in
who
Norway.
Writes a letter in Norwegian. And I very guiltily, as I was reading it, thinking, should I be... I'm an academic. I'm supposed to be thorough. I should be getting this translated. But presumably it is in perfect Norwegian.
It is perfect Norwegian, yeah. And the book sells incredibly well in Norway.
Does it? What, because of that letter?
I think it must be. I think it must be, because it's a running joke throughout all the books. And they stopped talking about the Norwegian leather industry.
Yes.
But that used to be his party conversation. He would pin people down and tell them about the Norwegian leather industry. And he was very good on it. He knew everything,
yes.
You know.
Yeah.
Had files and box files on it.
I think it was at the end of the Wilderness years that Adrian seemed to have it all. He had the love of Jojo. He'd been told by Angela Hacker, I believe, that he was a writer, and he realised that his thing, as he called it, wasn't as small. And he had friends at Savages. I'm so glad you did write another one, but will you ever let Adrian have it all again?
Yeah, I will, yeah. I mean, after all, he's now 41 three quarters or something, so it's... Yeah, I will allow him to have it all again. And then, of course, whether it lasts or not, that's up to him.
Well, I detect a sort of groundswell of hope that, I mean, I think there's quite a lot of well wishes to poor Adrian amongst us.
Yeah, I think so.
Because some very ignoble characters in European literature come off quite well and jammily.
I must admit that I really fell for Adrian in the last book. And I don't think it's because of his illness, although it has to be said, I was probably going to hospital as often as Adrian was, almost daily at times. So, I knew that really well. And I knew that regular patients get to know the story of their nurse's life. And it's like a serial, almost. It's like, so what? Okay, so what did he do last night? You know, and it's great. Because they, you know, you do get a very close relationship with people like that. And I will let him be happy. But I don't know what over. I mean, he's such a terrible writer. He can't ever be published by a bona fide publisher. I mean, somebody may pay secretly for a vanity publisher to print his horrible manuscript of Lo, the Flat Hills of My Homeland.
Well, anyway, we've had that public promise of his eventual felicity, yeah. I think, haven't we?
Yeah.
Well, I think I'm sure Sue would be happy to go on talking about Adrian as long as the evening lasted, but I think we need to free her. And we've got some good news, which is that we're hoping he's going to be happy in some way, shape or form. You're not supposed to clap.
No, you.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.